Welcome to CII's podcast, The Voice of Corporate Governance. While this podcast is open to the public, the majority of our work is only accessible to current CII member organizations. If you would like information on becoming a member of CII, please visit our website at CII.org or contact our Director of Membership, Melissa Fader, with her email, melissa@CII.org. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Council of Institutional Investors podcast on corporate governance and capital markets regulation. I'm Jeff Mahoney, General Counsel of CII. The purpose of these monthly episodes is to update CII members and the general public on developments in U.S. corporate governance and capital market legislation and CII's related advocacy activities. This update covers a period from November 30th to January 4th, 2022. So let's get started with the United States Congress. On November 30th, Representative Patrick McHenry of North Carolina, the ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee, and Bill Huizenga of Michigan, the top Republican on the Subcommittee on Investor Protection, Entrepreneurship, and Capital Markets, sent a letter to Committee Chair Maxine Waters of California. The letter asked Chair Waters to join with Republicans on the committee who are trying to get answers about the Securities and Exchange Commission's alleged purge of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board last June. You may recall the Securities and Exchange Commission announced on June 4th that it had removed William Dunkey from his position as chair of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and replaced him with existing board member Dwayne Duparte as acting chair. Chair Dunkey's term was set to expire in October 2022. At the same time, the commission also announced that it intended to seek candidates to fill all five board positions on the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and had directed the Office of the Chief Accountant to begin the process of soliciting new applications. And three of the board members at the time were in the middle of their five-year terms. On November 8th, SEC Chair Gary Gensler announced four replacements to the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. During his tenure as Public Company Accounting Oversight Board Chair, Mr. Dunkey was criticized by some for not holding meetings of the Investor Advisory Group or Standing Advisory Group. In addition, whistleblowers accused the former aide to Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama of creating a sense of fear at the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, and he was sued by a former chief administration officer whose claims included allegations of Mr. Dunkey using racial epithets. The November 30th letter from Representatives McHenry and Huizenga to Chair Waters says that SEC Chair Gary Gensler and Commissioner Allison Herron Lee, quote, may have orchestrated a purge of the board for partisan purposes, unquote. Representatives McHenry and Huizenga also say in the letter the evidence they have seen so far suggests there is no valid basis to remove Chair Dunkey or any other board member. The letter also says the SEC is refusing to produce non-public records related to the dismissals. The letter indicates that the commission's lawyers will not provide any additional records unless Chair Waters endorses an outstanding request from the committee's Republicans for the information. Lawmakers also said that in light of the seriousness of the allegations against Chair Gensler and Commissioner Lee, quote, we respectfully urge you to join committee Republicans in seeking answers from the SEC, unquote. On December 9th, the House Financial Services Committee held a hearing to review the findings and recommendations of a report prepared by the majority staff of the committee entitled Diversity and Inclusion, Holding America's Largest Investment Firms Accountable. In compiling the report, Committee Chair Maxine Waters of California and Diversity and Inclusion Subcommittee Chair Joyce Beatty of Ohio sent a letter to the 31 largest U.S. investment managers requesting data on diversity across several fronts, including their workforce, board, and asset management teams. According to a report at those firms, women comprised 27.5% of executive level management. People of color comprised 17.3% of executive level management. Only one firm has a person of color as the CEO, and three firms have white women as their CEOs. Women comprise 28% of the investment firm boards. People of color comprise 17.5% of the investment firm boards. 9 of the 28 firms that responded provided information on women-owned asset managers with which they do business. Those firms indicated that they spend on average 0.6% of the total they spend on asset management services with women-owned businesses. Firms also said they spend on average 3.96% of total asset management services with minority asset managers. To help increase diversity, the report recommends that investment firms take 5 actions. 1, collect disaggregated data regularly on workforce, executive and board diversity, and conduct regular audits on pay and racial equity. 2, partner with historically Black colleges and universities, minority-serving institutions, and community colleges to build talent pipelines into these organizations. 3, consider at least one diverse candidate for all executive positions and board positions when there are openings. 4, consider diverse suppliers whenever a procurement takes place, especially when contracting for asset managers. And 5, develop pipeline programs for diverse asset managers to manage increasingly large portfolios. At the hearing, Michelle Gadsden Williams, Managing Director of Human Resources and Global Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at BlackRock, testified that in the summer of 2020, BlackRock committed to increase its overall representation of Black and Latinx employees by 30%, double the number of Black and Latinx senior leaders, and increase its senior female representation to 32.5% by 2024. She reported that we are on track to meet these goals. Ms. Gadsden Williams noted that BlackRock also launched its diverse manager program in 2020, and as a result, now has $7 billion allocated to 30 diverse third-party asset managers, another $8 billion allocated to partially diverse-owned managers. Cyrus Tiruporevala, president and CEO of State Street Global Advisors, told lawmakers that his firm has increased the racial diversity of its corporate board from 9% to 25% and has adopted a global diverse candidate slate requirement for middle management and above, and recently announced it will undertake a full civil rights audit. Mr. Tiruporevala also explained that State Street Global Advisors improved the diversity and effectiveness of the syndicates underwriting its corporate debt by introducing Black, Latinx, women, and veteran-owned firms in issuances of $1.3 billion over the past year. Let's now turn to the Biden administration. On December 2nd, CII sent a letter to the Department of Labor generally supporting its proposed rule on ESG investing and proxy voting with some suggestions for improvements. CII said in the letter that we believe there is an emerging consensus based on a growing body of research that ESG factors can be economically material investment factors. CII noted that a majority of institutional investors now report using ESG data as part of their decision-making process and cited a recently updated CII publication entitled Empirical Research on ESG Factors and Engaged Ownership. To improve the proposed rule, CII suggested the Department of Labor adopt the following 7 CII recommendations. 1, clarify wording to avoid suggesting that a fiduciary must always consider ESG factors. 2, eliminate the requirement that a fiduciary disclose the specific collateral benefits it considered when making an investment. 3, eliminate the unnecessary and unreasonable requirements in the financial factors rule related to the use of ESG factors in the selection of qualified default investment alternatives. 4, revise the proposed example of governance factors to include the core corporate governance principle of one share, one vote. 5, retain the amendment to the proxy rule, limiting the statement that the fiduciary duty to manage shareholder rights are pertinent to shares of stock does not require the voting of every proxy or the exercise of every shareholder right. 6, eliminate enhanced proxy voting monitoring and record-keeping requirements. And 7, retain a portion of the proxy rule that explicitly permits fiduciaries to establish standing proxy voting policies. On December 17th, the Financial Stability Oversight Council met in executive session, at which it received 3 items. 1, an update from SEC Chair Gary Gensler on forthcoming proposed SEC rulemakings. 2, a presentation from the Federal Reserve, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Office of the Comptroller of Currency Staffs on their crypto asset policy sprint initiative. And 3, an update from Department of Treasury staff regarding ongoing work on climate-related financial risks. The Financial Stability Oversight Council also met in open session, at which it received an update from the Federal Reserve staff on the LIBOR transition and unanimously voted to approve 3 items. 1, a charter establishing a staff-level climate-related financial risk committee to serve as a venue for the staffs of council members and member agencies to collaborate and share information regarding potential climate-related risks. 2, the minutes of its November 15th, 2021 meeting. And 3, the Financial Stability Oversight Council's 2021 annual report. The unanimously approved 2021 annual report examines significant financial market and regulatory developments in light of the COVID-19 pandemic and concludes that although regulatory reforms adopted after the 2008 financial crisis strengthened the ability of the financial system to withstand a shock or an economic downturn, the risks to U.S. financial stability today are elevated compared to before the pandemic, with the outlook for global growth characterized by elevated uncertainty and the potential for continued volatility and unevenness of growth across countries and sectors. In particular, the report identifies several emerging threats and vulnerabilities to U.S. financial stability, including the following 5 items. 1, the physical and transition risks associated with climate change. 2, elevated leverage of non-financial corporations relative to historical standards. 3, structural vulnerabilities in certain short-term wholesale funding markets, including money market funds. 4, the transition away from LIBOR, and 5, cybersecurity risks. Accordingly, the Financial Stability Oversight Council recommends that member agencies, among other measures, take 3 actions. 1, continue to monitor levels of non-financial business leverage, trends in asset valuations, and potential implications for the entities they regulate to assess and reinforce the ability of the financial sector to manage severe simultaneous losses. 2, determine whether regulatory relief is required to encourage market participants to address legacy LIBOR portfolios. And 3, work to improve information sharing among private firms and government partners to share timely and actionable cybersecurity information. Observing that some private equity firms are acquiring life insurers or assuming life business in order to assess and leverage long-term assets, the report also cautions that this intersection may increase interconnectivity among non-bank lenders, insurers, and the broader financial sector, while exposing a growing investor base to lending activities that may be subject to less regulatory scrutiny. Although it acknowledges that certain digital assets may present potential benefits, the Financial Stability Oversight Council warns that they may be subject to the risk of operational failures, fraud, and market manipulation, and pose risk through direct or indirect connections with banking services, financial markets, and financial intermediaries. Cautioning that runs on a stable coin arrangement could occur that may result in harm to users in the broader financial system if stablecoin issuers do not honor a request to redeem a stable coin, or users lose confidence in a stablecoin issuer's ability to honor such request. The Financial Stability Oversight Council recommends that member agencies consider the recommendations in the recently published report on stablecoins by the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. Financial Stability Oversight Council will also be prepared to consider steps available to it to address risk outlined in the President's Working Group on Financial Markets report in the event comprehensive legislation governing stable coins is not enacted. Moving now to activities of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. On December 2nd, the SEC's Investor Advisory Committee hosted a panel discussion entitled Crypto and Digital Assets, Helping to Ensure Investor Protection and Market Integrity in the Face of New Technology. Speaking at the beginning of the session, SEC Chair Gary Gensler said the crypto asset class belongs inside public policy frameworks of looking after investors, guarding against illicit activity, and protecting our financial stability. Commissioner Hester Peirce expressed her views that the commission should provide regulatory clarity on its approach to crypto assets, regulate with a lighter hand, and focus on investor access. Moderated by Cambria Allen Ratzlaff of the U.S. Retiree Medical Benefits Trust, Theodore Daniels of the Society for Financial Education and Professional Development, the panel discussed how the SEC can regulate crypto assets to ensure investor protection in two sections, focusing on the academic, regulatory, and investor protection perspectives first, and the industry, trading, and policy perspectives next. Investor protection concerns about crypto assets mentioned by panelists included lack of liquidity, high barriers to entry, and susceptibility to fraud and hacking. Participants also noted the potential benefits of such markets, including lower trading costs, greater inclusivity, and the lack of third-party intermediaries. Speakers also had varying views on the ability of the SEC to regulate various crypto assets within the existing regulatory framework and the potential need for a bespoke framework. Timothy Massud, former chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, suggested that the SEC use its authority to create standards for stable coins and crypto exchanges. Mr. Massud also suggested that the SEC consider creating a new self-regulatory organization to develop standards on how to regulate the decentralized finance landscape. Angela Dalton of Signum Growth Capital emphasized the need for common sense regulation for decentralized autonomous organizations to allow for swifter action, provide better education and disclosure about how those entities operate. In the second panel, Alex Goldstein of the Open Markets Institute emphasized the need to reduce gaps in investor protection between equity marketplaces and crypto marketplaces and said many SEC tools are appropriate for crypto markets. Kristen Smith of the Blockchain Association disagreed, saying that it would not make sense to regulate crypto markets as traditional securities markets, since she believes crypto markets to be more secure, more efficient, and more democratic. Sydney Schwab from digital asset custodian Gemini indicated support for a new regime that could take into consideration the technological complexities of crypto assets. On December 8th, the SEC published a proposed rule to require lenders of stock and other securities to give the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority material information about each loan, including data on its timing, duration, venue of execution, rate or fee charged, and collateral. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority would in turn make the information public. In a statement, the SEC said current lack of transparency in the securities lending market makes it difficult for borrowers and lenders to know whether the terms of their loans are consistent with market conditions. Also, under the proposed rule, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority will collect but not disclose the identities of borrowers and lenders, as well as whether the loan's purpose is to close out or fail to deliver. Some cases of fail to deliver results from so-called naked short selling, whereby a short seller sells shares he or she never borrowed. The proposal suggests that the non-public data sought could help regulators understand how episodes of extreme market volatility occur. The value of the U.S. securities lending market in the U.S. is estimated at $1.5 trillion, according to a 2020 report by the Financial Stability Oversight Council. Comments on the SEC proposal are due March 7th. On December 9th, addressing the Healthy Markets Association, SEC Chair Gary Gensler discussed the economic drivers of special purpose acquisition companies, asserting that the investing public may not be getting the same protections between traditional IPOs and SPACs, arguing that the so-called de-SPAC merger process or SPAC target IPO is functionally akin to a traditional IPO. Chair Gensler emphasized that SPAC investors deserve the protections they receive from traditional IPOs with respect to information asymmetries, fraud and conflicts, and when it comes to disclosure, marketing practices, and gatekeepers. In particular, Chair Gensler raised concerns that SPAC sponsors may be priming the market without providing robust disclosures to the public to back up their claims, and accordingly has asked SEC staff to craft recommendations to guard against what effectively may be improper conditioning of the SPAC market, which could include providing more complete information at the time that a SPAC target IPO is announced, noting that there may be some who attempt to use SPACs as a way to arbitrage liability regimes. Chair Gensler stressed that when it comes to liability, SPACs do not provide a free pass for gatekeepers. And he said he's asked SEC staff for recommendations on how the commission can, one, better align incentives between gatekeepers and investors, and two, address the status of gatekeepers' liability obligations. Observing that there's inconsistent and differential disclosure among the various parties involved in a SPAC transaction, and that retail investors may not be getting adequate information about how their shares can be diluted throughout the various stages of a SPAC, Chair Gensler has also asked SEC staff to consider two actions. One, clarifying disclosure obligations under existing rules, and two, recommendations intended to better inform investors about the fees, projections, dilution, and conflicts that may exist during all stages of SPACs. While the commission evaluates these policy areas, Chair Gensler pledged that the Enforcement Division will continue to be the cop on the beat to ensure that investors are being protected in the SPAC space. And he said he has asked the division to take all appropriate action following the facts and the law to protect investors in these vehicles. Also on December 9th, CI sent a letter to the SEC urging the commission to recheck NASDAQ's proposed rule change to adopt alternate listing requirements for certain special purpose acquisition companies. Under the proposal, NASDAQ wants to allow certain SPACs to initially list on the NASDAQ global market with at least 300 round lot holders rather than 400 round lot holders, which is currently required. They also would remain listed if they have at least 300 public stockholders, provided that they meet certain additional requirements for initial and continued listing. In opposing the alternative listing requirements, CII noted that NASDAQ failed to provide data showing that special purpose acquisition companies have had difficulty complying with the current 400 round lot holders requirement. The letter also questioned whether some of NASDAQ's justifications for the proposed changes are consistent with the interests of investors. More broadly, the letter emphasized the poor governance practices that appear endemic to special purpose acquisition company structures. Specifically, it cited challenges that many special purpose acquisition companies have in complying with CII's corporate governance policies on board independence and director compensation. CII stated in the letter that, quote, "We believe these challenges have significant implications for the protection of investors and the public interest," unquote. On December 13th, the SEC staff reversed the approach to shareholder proposal no action decisions that it adopted in 2019 and will once again be issuing written responses. Staff of the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance had discontinued the longstanding practice of responding to each shareholder proposal no action request with a written letter. Instead, they drafted a written letter only in limited instances and communicated the vast majority of responses via notations to a chart maintained on the division's website. The SEC announcement said that, quote, "We have reconsidered this approach, and after review of the practice, we believe that written responses will provide greater transparency and certainty to shareholder proponents and companies alike," unquote. Effective immediately, SEC staff will once again respond to each shareholder proposal no action request with a written letter. Those letters will be posted publicly on the division's website in a timely manner. Although responses will no longer be communicated via chart, the chart will be published after the 2021 proxy season. Shortly after the SEC's 2019 announcement to generally halt written responses, CII Series, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, USCIF, and the Shareholder Rights Group sent a joint letter to the SEC saying they were concerned that the staff's new approach would reduce transparency and accountability, increase the burden on investors, and could increase conflict between companies and their investors. On December 14th, CII and the CFA Institute sent a joint letter to the SEC on the Commission's proposed amendments to Form N-PX. The joint letter generally supports the proposed changes, made suggestions for improvements. The amendments build on rules that the SEC adopted in 2003, requiring mutual funds, ETFs, other registered management investment companies report on Form N-PX, how they voted on each resolution at shareholder meetings held the previous year. Overall, the joint letter says standardizing the language to describe proxy proposals will help investors better compare how funds vote on particular proposals, and having reporting persons categorize their votes will help investors concentrate on the topics they find most important. The letter also says the benefits of increased transparency and investor clients outweigh those costs associated with tracking, gathering, and disclosing information. While supporting categorization of shareholder proposals, the letter also cautions that assigning items to one or more specific subcategories, particularly the ESG-related subcategories as proposed, may require a high degree of judgment, leading to divergence among Form N-PX filers. Letter warns, quote, as a result, such divergence could detract from the subcategory's intended usefulness and potentially mislead users of the reports, unquote. CII, the CFA Institute, encourage investors to work together to establish an industry agreed upon solution in place of the proposed subcategory requirements that could evolve over time. Letter also supports the proposed requirement that reporting persons disclose the number of shares instructed to be voted, along with the number of shares alone but not recalled. To make this proposed disclosure far more meaningful, the joint letter recommends that the SEC require that companies issue proxy statements before the record date for the annual meeting. The joint letter explains that without such a reform, institutional investors often are unable to determine whether the expected benefit of recalling and voting the shares loan exceeds the expected benefit of lending of those shares. CII and the CFA Institute also expressed support for requiring managers to report annually on Form N-PX each say-on-pay vote over which the manager exercised voting power, and for hedge funds and endowments to report their say-on-pay votes. The two groups also say the proposed requirements that proxy voting disclosures be available on fund websites where they can be read digitally and downloaded, would increase investor access and enable investors to more easily find information about a fund's voting history. On December 15th, in an early holiday gift to investors, the SEC unanimously approved proposed rules that would close loopholes and enhance transparency of executive trading plans in company stock. CII is pressed for reform of these Rule 10b5-1 trading plans for a decade, and its advocacy is referenced multiple times in the rule proposal. The same meeting, the commissioners also approved proposals on stock buybacks, security-based swap transactions, and money market fund rules. As background, in 2008, after CII members became concerned about a number of practices that appeared to indicate that these Rule 10b5-1 plans were not adopted in good faith, or that material non-public information was a factor in decisions to trade through the plans, CII adopted a member-approved policy on Rule 10b5-1 plans. To prompt SEC action on the issue, CII then submitted a rulemaking petition in 2012, urging the commission to adopt amendments that would place restrictions on the trading that companies and company insiders could conduct under the rule. More recently, yours truly testified June 1st before the SEC's Investor Advisory Committee on Rule 10b5-1 plans, urging the commission to close existing loopholes. The SEC's proposed rules on 10b5-1 plans would require the following five items. One, corporate officers or directors who enter into 10b5-1 trading arrangements or make modifications to arrangements to wait 120 days before they begin trading. Two, companies that enter into 10b5-1 trading arrangements or make changes to plans to wait 30 days before they begin trading. Three, officers and directors to certify that they are not aware of material non-public information about a company or company stock when adopting a new or modified trading arrangement. Four, the prohibition of overlapping plans and limiting single trade plans to one every 12 months. And five, all 10b5-1 trading arrangements be entered into and operated in good faith. Proposed rules also would require enhanced disclosure regarding 10b5-1 trading plans, option grants, and companies' insider trading policies and procedures, including the following six disclosures. One, companies disclose in their annual reports whether or not they have adopted insider trading policies and procedures, and if they have, what these are. Two, companies disclose in their annual reports their option grant policies and practices and provide tabular disclosure showing grants made within 14 days of the release of material non-public information and the market price of the underlying securities on the trading day before and after the release of such information. Three, companies disclose in their quarterly reports the adoption and termination of Rule 10b5-1 trading arrangements and other trading arrangements by directors, officers, and companies, and the terms of such trading arrangements. Five, officers and directors disclose whether a reported transaction was made under a 10b5-1c trading arrangement. And six, Section 16 insiders disclose promptly gifts of securities. SEC Chair Gary Gensler said the proposed 10b5-1 related amendments would help close potential gaps in our insider trading regime and more broadly increase investor confidence in the markets. Although SEC Commissioners Hester Peirce and Elad Roisman voted for the amendments, in their remarks, they raised concerns. Commissioner Peirce's concerns centered around the certification requirement, the condition that plans be operating in good faith, and disclosure requirements related to spring-loaded options. Commissioner Roisman said he believes that the 120-day cooling-off period is sufficient to address any problems related to Rule 10b5-1 plans. He added, quote, "To say that I have reservations about other aspects of the proposal is an understatement," unquote. Both Commissioner Peirce and Commissioner Roisman objected to the 45-day comment period for this and the other proposals voted on at the meeting, saying it was far too short. At the same meeting, the commissioners voted in a 3-2 vote, approving amendments that require companies to provide more detailed and more frequent and timely disclosure about stock buybacks and to tag that information using inline XBRL. Under the proposed stock buyback rules, companies would have to file a new form SR before the end of the first business day following the day they conduct a share repurchase. On that form, they would have to disclose the following four items of information. One, the class of securities purchased. Two, the total amount purchased. Three, the average price paid. And four, the aggregate total amount purchased on the open market. The proposed amendments related to stock buybacks also would build upon current stock buybacks disclosure requirements by adding the following three elements of information about one, the objective or rationale for the share repurchases and the process or criterion used to determine the repurchase amounts. Two, any policies and procedures related to the purchases and sales of a company's securities by its officers and directors during a repurchase program, including any restriction on such transactions. And three, whether the company is making repurchases to a plan that falls under Rule 10b5-1 or Rule 10b-18. Companies would also be required to indicate whether any of their officers or directors purchased or sold shares of the class of equity subject to the share repurchase plan or program within 10 business days before or after the announcement of the plan. Overall, CII has publicly expressed the view that stock buyback decisions are at their core capital allocation decisions, and that making it harder for companies to pursue stock buybacks could force them to sit on cash or waste it on projects with low potential for success. At the same time, however, CII has publicly stated that not all stock buybacks are appropriate, especially those that are conducted to boost the stock price in the short term in an effort to increase CEO pay that's linked to earnings per share or measures of capital efficiency. To avoid buybacks being used for the enrichment of corporate executives, ensure that they are being conducted with interests of long-term investors in mind, CII has long supported more prompt disclosure of buyback execution programs and increased disclosure about who will participate in a buyback and how it will affect executive compensation. In approving the proposal on stock buybacks, SEC Chair Gary Gensler stated, "Share buybacks have become a significant component of how public issuers return capital to shareholders." He added, "I think we can lessen the information asymmetries between issuers and investors through enhanced timeliness and granularity of disclosures that today's proposal would provide." Commissioner Hester Peirce, who did not support the proposed amendments related to stock buybacks, said any information asymmetries between companies and investors should be addressed through a more tailored requirement to disclose buyback announcements and terminations. Commissioner Elad Roisman, who also dissented from the proposed buyback rule, warned that the burden of daily reporting could deter companies from conducting buybacks at all. And if they do go forward, the daily reports could provide roadmaps for traders to game the repurchases. At the December 15th meeting, the SEC also approved proposed rules aimed at preventing fraud, manipulation, and deception in connection with security-based swap transactions, and proposed amendments to certain rules that govern money market funds under the Investment Company Act of 1940. On December 20th, SEC Commissioner Elad Roisman sent a letter to President Joe Biden resigning from the commission effective the end of January. Commissioner Roisman was nominated in 2018 to the SEC by former President Donald Trump, briefly served as acting chairman after former SEC Chairman Jay Clayton resigned from the agency in 2020. Commissioner Roisman had previously been the chief counsel to Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee and counsel to former SEC Commissioner Daniel Gallagher. Commissioner Roisman played a key role drafting the SEC's proxy advisor and shareholder proposal rules and has continued to support those rules, both of which were opposed by most investors and became the subject of litigation. Commissioner Roisman, as well as Commissioner Hester Peirce, has been critical of Chair Gensler's push for new climate risk reporting regimes and skeptical of environmental, social, and governance regulations. The SEC also announced a new director of the Division of Investment Management, William Birdthistle. Mr. Birdthistle is currently a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law. He also has served as visiting professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Mr. Birdthistle's research explores investment funds, securities regulation, and corporate governance, and he has served as counsel of record on multiple amicus briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court. Prior to academia, Mr. Birdthistle practiced law at Robeson Gray in Boston as a corporate associate in the firm's investment management practice. Mr. Birdthistle also authored Empire of the Fund, The Way We Save Now, a look at the problems and scandals that have beset the mutual fund industry. In a December 23rd letter, CII encouraged the SEC to rescind the commission's 2020 proxy advisor rules in their entirety, but alternatively also offered suggestions on how to improve the proposed changes to those rules. CII asserted in the letter that rescinding all of the 2020 rules would be the superior approach because it would give proxy advisors and investors the flexibility to select those mechanisms that best serve the needs of investors and adapt to evolving market practices. CII recommended that if, however, the SEC decides instead to make changes to the 2020 rules and retain them, it should amend the proposed rules to clarify that a proxy advisor would not be subject to liability for its voting recommendations or any subjective determinations it makes in formulating those recommendations. CI cautioned the risk of litigation would potentially increase the cost and impair the independence of proxy voting advice that investors use to make voting decisions. CI's letter also supports the proposed rescinding of the provisions of the 2020 rules that it require. CI's letter also supports the proposed rescinding of the provisions of the 2020 rules that require proxy advisors to send companies the reports about upcoming corporate meetings and their proxy voting recommendations. CI explained that this requirement, the 2020 rules, would adversely affect the independence, cost, and timeliness of proxy voting advice. CI added that market-based incentives, not the 2020 rules, would help ensure accuracy and quality in proxy advisors' reports. In the letter, CI also recommended the SEC scrap the 2020 guidance that it issued, instructing investment advisors to consider any company's responses to proxy voting advice prior to exercising their voting authority. CI explained that the 2020 requirement that proxy advisors provide companies with the reports and voting recommendations ahead of shareholder meetings were rescinded. As proposed, the 2020 guidance would no longer be necessary. Furthermore, CI's letter said that if the 2020 guidance were implemented, it would add to uncertainty and delays in procurement of proxy voting advice. Overall, CI said that the proxy advisor rulemaking was in part driven by the unethical behavior and practices of some who have actively promoted false and misleading information to the commission and staff and to the general public. CII urged the commission to act as soon as possible to redirect resources devoted to this unnecessary proxy advisor rulemaking to the longstanding need to modernize the proxy infrastructure. That completes my monthly corporate governance and capital markets update. If you have any questions regarding any of the issues discussed or CII's related public positions, please feel free to email me at Jeff, J-E-F-F, at CII. .org. That's Jeff, J-E-F-F, at CII.org. Until next time, I'm Jeff Mahoney. Thanks for listening and have a happy new year.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Voice of Corporate Governance, brought to you by the Council of Institutional Investors. The Voice of Corporate Governance is a free, non-sponsored podcast that highlights critical developments in corporate governance and other important issues affecting institutional investors. The views expressed by those interviewed on the podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of CII or its members. For more information on CII and its policies on corporate governance, please visit our website at www.cii.org.